Good morning, Ben. My name is Gino, and by the grace of God and practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a sober man. And it is an absolute honor and privilege to be here today amongst you men. Jimmy, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it. And Chuck, congratulations. You're an inspiration, buddy, to a lot of people. And that's good stuff. Thanks for doing all the things you do. My hope here today, man, is, of course, to be honest and just share my experience, strength, and hope with you. All I really ask is that you identify with what I have to say and not compare with me. Everything that comes out of my mouth is of my experience. That's the intent. So I'm going to just take a moment here to pray to God. All right. Well, let me qualify here as a drunk first, right? What allows me to come onto this meeting and share is that I could not control and enjoy my drinking, but I desperately, desperately tried. And I'm one of those guys that never had a chance. I don't know exactly when my first drink was because I grew up, like Jimmy said, we grew up in South Buffalo and, you know, you would run to the fridge to get a beer and they'd offer you a sip. And I was a little boy. I don't know. I might have had whiskey put on my teeth to, numb the teething. I don't know. That's just the way that I was raised. But I know the first time I got drunk was at my niece's baptism. And it was a rarity to have booze at my house. And there was a kegger in the backyard. And I didn't even do it alone. Me and the next door neighbor were stealing, sneaking little styrofoam cups off the keg, 10 years old, got drunk, blacked out, puked, passed out, and got mocked out endlessly by I'm the youngest of eight, my brothers and sisters after that. And I mean, not much of a first drunk in South Buffalo. Yeah, there are social drinkers at 10, 11, 12 years old where I grew up in a neighborhood that I grew up. Now, I know that that's not normal. I know it's not healthy, but that's just the neighborhood that I grew up in. And I wasn't alone. The problem was, is that when you grow up in an environment like that, it's hard to see that you have a problem. This illness makes it almost impossible for us to see that we have a problem to begin with, you know, that didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know. But to grow up in an environment where alcohol is just such a part of the culture, it's, you know, jails, institutions, and death, right? That's where it leads guys like me. And my drinking was never good. I was never this guy that like could catch a buzz and just chill out, but I lived my life just trying to do that. And we would steal beer. I'm still friends with guys that I grew up with. And we joke about there's a consumer's beverage on a corner of the street that we went to Catholic school at. And we would walk home and like sticking our hands through those grates of those metal grates that you close over the opening. And there'd be beers and you could like grab a beer. And we would pass it through the grates to hand to get it over and steal beers. And we're doing that in sixth grade. I think, I don't know, what are you, 11, 12 years old? We'd meet up at the corner to get a buyer and you'd have, I don't know, $2 between the four of you. And you'd look at each other, you had 50 cent pounders. I don't know if you guys know 50 cent Genesee pounder, 16 ounces. And we go, yeah, four of them ain't cutting it. So what do we get? We got Mad Dog 2020. Ever drink some Mad Dog 2020 or a little Wild Irish Rose? And, you know, we had a buyer, Ella Bird. And that's just the way that we rolled. And you try to get to the park as fast as you could before the older boys stole it from you, because that's what they would do. And that's what was done to them. And we didn't invent this. We were taught this. We were just following in line. You know, if you grew up in South Buffalo and you drank at Cassie, you know all about the Yellow Bridge. There's nothing I need to tell you about that. And it's kind of was like rites of passage. And I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I also thought that everybody blacked out when they drank. Doesn't everybody black out when they're drinking? Am I the only guy in this room that blacked out drinking? Don't you drink till you puke? Or you feel that buzz coming on, right? You know, I don't know. It's coming on, and you know it's coming, and you got to make a big decision. Am I going home? Am I blacking out? Or am I going to force puke? I learned that. I was high school. Am I the only guy here that did that? Like, your belly's full. You're like, oh, this ain't gonna be good. And you just be like, sneak over, and you go, oh, and just puke it all out to clear the way so you could get some more in you. That's normal at 15, right? That's what you do to keep going, to keep the party going. There's also something that went on at 15 that was pretty awful. My father passed. And if there's a date on a calendar of like that point of no return that we talk about, where you go into that place that no human power can save you from this, from the drink and the compulsion to drink. That was it. That was February 86. And shortly after that, I was taken to my first AA meeting by friends of my father. He worked at the steel plant, and we were a poor family. And I found out how poor we were when he died. And though I wasn't raised poor, I didn't think I was poor, but when my father died, it was, and I was the baby in the family, and it was not good. And so my drinking got out of control, where I was drinking all the time, and I had developed a marijuana, I became a pothead is what I was. So if I wasn't drinking, I was smoking weed every day, and I was a wake and bake guy. And so I get brought to my first AA meeting in October of 1986. And I pray to God I never forget this, because I'm going on a long ride and these guys are telling me about the, I'm already in trouble at school. I come from that big family in South Buffalo where, they know you're drunk. I know we say here that you can't, only you can tell yourself you're an alcoholic. Well, that's not my experience. My experience was the all the school teachers were telling me I was a drunk. My friends were telling me I was a drunk. My family members were telling me a drunk. The neighbors were telling me I was a, everybody was like, this guy's a drunk. He's got it. He's got it bad. I was always like out of control. I just was. And the reason why I was brought to my first meeting in October of 86 was I was that out of control, and I had taken my sister's car for a joyride and got caught. Now, I didn't get the DWI, but I got caught, and it was bad trouble in my family because that's not how I was raised. I come from a family of hardworking blue-collar people, cops, firemen, nurses, teachers. You're not supposed to act that way at any age, let alone as a teenager. And that's what was going on. And then, when we talk about always worse, never better. The more I drank, the more trouble I got in. So there I was in AA, and these guys are giving me the talk. If you've ever been taken to your first meeting by a couple guys, and you're sitting in a car, and they're telling you about the illness, and they're telling you about, 12 stepping you, and they're like telling me, because they knew I was a blackout drunk. I made the mistake of telling them I don't remember anything, and they're like, "That's blackouts, kid. That leads to wet brain." I'm like, "Wet brain? What the hell are you guys talking about?" And these guys were war veterans. Like, my father was Korean War. And they take me up to the VA hospital, and they take me up to the flight deck, up to the 10th floor. And they walk me out on the 10th floor, and there's all the guys that are wet brained, the veterans. They're sitting in wheelchairs, and they're drilling. And that's what they're telling me. You're going to go into a blackout. You're not going to come out of it. And this is how you're going to wind up. Of course, I don't believe them. I think it's a scare tactic. Then they take me down to the floor where the meeting was. And we walk in, and there's this, oh, this guy was an icon of Alcoholics Anonymous, though I didn't know it at the time, George Fitz. I gotta honor him right now. And he's sitting there, and he's got the slippers on with the smiley face, and these guys' jaws dropped, and they were in shock. And they could not believe that George had drank. I guess he had 15 years of sobriety and drank that weekend. He was a regular attendee at meetings, and everybody knew who this guy was but me. What's my punky attitude? I'm like, huh, look at you guys. I mean, tears were in their eyes. And I'm thinking, see, this don't work. You guys acting all tough, blah, blah. It's just such a punk. And that was my attitude. And that was October of 86. So that started my journey of every time I went out and drunk, thinking I'm not that bad. I'm just not that bad. I don't know if you can identify with that. So every time I got in trouble, I wound up in AA. And I'm the guy that spent 7 years of chronic relapsing. From 1986 to 1993, I went in and out of meetings. I probably went to 1,000 AA meetings. I tried every form of drinking you could possibly think of. Beer, wine, just like it's, I'm just garden variety. I thought I was all unique. I'm a garden variety drunk. I tried smoking weed and not drinking. I thought that was a magic elixir. If I just smoke weed, I didn't black out. I didn't get in trouble when I was high. I didn't do much of anything. I didn't make it to class. I didn't make it to work. You know, if you've ever heard, if you ever had a girlfriend look at you dead in the face and go, "You just don't get it. You don't get me. You don't understand me. What's wrong with you?" It's because I'm high all the time. I can't get her. There is no emotional connection. They were just, if you ever had a crowded lunchroom in your head, where it won't shut off, and I needed something to shut that off, right? Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, I am that restless, irritable, discontented guy. I am that guy that needs to shut the voices off. And that was one of the things that calmed me down. And but every time I drank, it was a blackout. I became homeless after coming to AA. I went to a place called the Franciscan Center, where you went to 2-a-day meetings. I got a spiritual advisor there, Father Ken. And you know, I thought I was the only teenager on planet Earth trying to get sober. I'm walking to meetings with five guys. Talk about terminal uniqueness, right? I'm walking to meetings with five guys my age, and thinking I'm the only one trying to get sober, right? That self-absorbed, can't see my environment. So I flunk out of there. And my family's seriously concerned that I'm going to get in trouble. You know, I'm not going to make it. At that point, my mother gets a funeral policy on me, which I found out later. She was advised to get a Prudential whole life funeral policy because everybody was expecting me to die. And that would pay for the funeral. It was a $15,000 whole life policy, which I did not know about until. You know, I found out eventually, but at that time I didn't know. So, and I was stealing from my mother, which was it. I, man, the things I did and how I couldn't understand how it related to other people. That's why I asked the guys identify, because I'd go to meetings. I'm 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, in trouble. And I couldn't understand that you guys were doing the same stuff that I did. I couldn't imagine Chuck being in college, blacking out. I just couldn't see it, right? I couldn't identify. And thank God for you guys. Thank God that, you know, when I'm stealing money from my mother and I don't want to, or my sister's person, I mean, my whole, until I got sober, even about 6 months into sobriety, my mother walked around the house with her purse attached to her head. If she got up off the couch to go to the bathroom, the purse went with her. If she went to bed, the purse was under her pillow. And I didn't want to steal from her. I didn't want to steal from my mother's purse. We had no money. But I had to, because once I started, I couldn't stop. And I didn't understand that. I thought I was a degenerate scumbag. And I'd steal from my sisters. And I didn't want to. I didn't steal from my brothers because they'd beat the shit out of me, right? So I want to get punched in the head. And it would kill me. And then I'd go to meetings. And one time a guy grabbed me at a meeting, and I was still in active addiction. I just went because I was in trouble. And he said, "You know, kid, me leaving work and going to the bar and spending my paycheck and coming home broke is no different than you stealing from your mother." I didn't hear that till I was about 4 years sober. It took, I don't know how long it took for me to hear that and identify with it and go, "Oh my goodness, you know." You know, but he, the whole time I was bouncing in and out, you guys were trying to help me. You guys were trying to help me see that I was a drunk and that it was always going to be worse and it was never going to be better. I developed a cocaine habit after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought that was, you know, rather than force myself to puke when that buzz came over me and it's like, oh, you know what I mean? You feel the blackout coming on and it's like, okay, go home, get home, or do some lines and keep the party going. And I was convinced that that was going to fix me. And a lot of you men helped me understand that as the obsession to control and enjoy my drinking. And while I'm going to these meetings back in the 80s and 90s, a lot of guys that sell Buffalo stalwarts, you know, "We don't talk about drugs here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We only talk about not drinking." And then I'd be like, "Well," and I'd feel like I kind of like on the outside. And it wasn't until that last debacle when you know, and I started to really cop. One thing I got it too is the resentments are real. And the worst thing that was going on with me at that time was judging you men and looking at you men and judging everything you had to say, looking for every, you know, I was so cynical. trying to prove that I could do this on my own, self-reliance, right? Without even knowing it. And trying to find every single reason to just disregard anything you might have had to say, that anybody had to say. And that swirling world of resentment, walking with an attitude, you know, and it just bars you from really being able to identify or hear anything. And the last drunk that I had after years of coming to meetings, I'm not kidding you, probably 1,000 AA meetings, homeless shelter, counseling, developed a cocaine habit, had a sponsor, my first, who's, of course, my first sponsor who's died drunk and high. He told me it was okay to smoke weed, so he was perfect for a guy like me, right? Yeah, that's it. Let's do that. Let's talk about God and get high, right? And not a good, if that worked, I'm not talking to you men today. I'm just not. If you could beat alcoholism out of someone and just punch it out of them, I'm sober because I got the crap beat out of me a lot of times drunk. I got the crap beat out of me a lot of times hungover for doing things. That's just how my family was. You know, I had big brothers. They were convinced that I was going to give my mother a heart attack. And if you could beat it out of someone, I'm sober that way. And if you could sex it out, because I thought a woman would fix me. Shocker, right? I know I'm so unique in all my thinking, right? In all my actions. So if a really pretty girl, a good ass whooping and some marijuana could have fixed me, I am not talking to any human. But that just doesn't work for a guy like me. And it sucked. It really did. And in education, I'm college educated. And I know the language of AA long before I got sober. I had how it works because, you know, it was treating it like class, right? If I sound good, then I'm good. If I can say all these things and I can talk on topics, then I'm not that bad. And I was just so delusional. And I thought it was all me. And what happens? I wound up in a jail cell in a blackout again. And after all that, after all those meetings, and I was crushed. You know, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization we talk about? I was devastated. And I didn't want to go to jail. I'm not meant to go to jail. I know that much. And, you know, I did the old jailhouse prayer, literally. Please, God, save me. Get me out of this one. I'll do anything. You know, and I was real on my knees begging. I didn't even know what I did. And there not much had changed from that first drunk at 10 years old to that last drunk at 22. I got drunk, puked, blacked out, passed out in a jail cell. The only thing that changed was the consequences. And what's always worse, never better. You guys have been telling me that for years. And there it was. And I'm in this jail cell, not knowing what I'd done. I've got to literally look at my hands. I'm looking for ink. Think, well, it ain't a felony. There's no ink. Well, it was. It was seven felonies. And they said, literally on my arrest report, too drunk to fingerprint. That was on my arrest report. And I was like, oh God, this is not good. And brought over to the jailhouse, part. Second floor, part four, Judge Broderick. It's just awful. It's such an embarrassment to myself, shame in my family. I knew the sheriff, he knew my family, he knew me, that brought me in front of the judge. He was yelling at me, you know. And my brothers were there to pick me up. There's a guy from downtown, I got to honor him, Ralph Perowski. And they told me right there outside the court, they let me go. I didn't know it was afternoon court. They couldn't wake me up for morning court. And I was told that I would be getting out of this if I didn't screw it up. But I had to stay sober. I went to rehab. I did all the stuff that I was supposed to do. That's what I was told. Start following the directions. The one thing that did happen that day was I knew I was an alcoholic. That great debate that I had been waging, that war against the drink, that, you know, I learned it from you guys, but that idea that somehow, someday I can control and enjoy my drinking, that there's a possible way for me to just catch a two-beer buzz and not turn into a psycho or not black out, it ended in that jail cell. I knew for the first time in my life, and I've known for every moment since, and I pray to God right now, as you guys as my witness, that it never be taken from me, that I am alcoholic. That was the big awakening in that jail cell. And it changed my entire life, that moment, because I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is where, you know, when we talk about steps, you know, that first step there, and I hope I qualified for you men as far as being a drunk goes. even though I was a young guy. I don't get to be a 25-year-old drunk or a 30-year-old drunk or a 40-year-old drunk. Guys like me die. That was March 30th, 1993. And I have not had a drink or a drug since then, by the grace of God. And these 12 steps, all of it, I don't know what part I can't do. But it wasn't an easy going for me. Knowing that I was a drunk, just now I need help. So I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And who's the first? South Buffalo used to have these gigantic meetings. And I know you guys have been to a lot of meetings, right? Like 100 people meetings. So I go to this meeting, this South Buffalo group, huge giant speaker meeting on a Friday night. And I walk in, and who's the first guy I see? George Fitz. You know? And he doesn't give me a shot. He doesn't say, you know, he doesn't wag his finger at me or anything. He just looks at me. He says, "Kid, you ready?" And I was like, you know, you seen him? And I'm like, yeah, I am. He stayed sober. He stayed sober. I seen that man drunk in October of 1987, and, you know, or October 86. And now it's 93, and he had maintained his sobriety up to that point. And I tell you what, that gave me faith. That gave me faith that this could work. Because I'm a Catholic boy. I was an altar boy. A lot of you guys, I know a lot of you men on here. We got a lot in common. And I was convinced that I wasn't good enough for God. I was convinced that I was going straight to hell with gasoline underwear on, and that I just wasn't worthy of God's grace. I didn't understand the mercy and love of God at that time. All I knew is that I've been broken probably nine for sure, maybe 10 of the big ones, you know, all 10 of the big ones. And I just wasn't worthy of God's love, even though I was out of jail. And that's what I begged for. And there's Fitz looking at me saying, "Kid, you ready?" But he was that first proof that maybe this worked. And I found a little faith in this because I was desperate. I was desperate to not get to go to jail. And I was desperate to not live that way anymore. And then I started to hear all the things that I could not hear before because I couldn't identify what you meant. I was so unique. But now in my soul, I knew I was alcoholic. I don't know. The veil got lifted. I could hear things like, "Hey, kid, a day at a time. One's too many. A thousand ain't enough. We do this together. It's a we program. You know, it's not me driving around in a car imagining, you know." And I could start to see that these guys that I had these attitudes towards, I was such a cynical prick. These guys stayed sober. I remember this one guy. It's funny because at that meeting, two huge things happened. My first meeting back. Fitz is there, sober, welcoming me, not wagging his finger at me, not telling me, "I told you so. Hey, kid, you ready? You know, anything you need, I'm here for you." What a welcoming. And then this guy, Charlie, that he was crazy. He used to talk to himself. And have you ever been in a meeting where some guy's walking around, he's talking to himself in the back of the meeting, da 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 da, right? He did that all the time. Here he is getting a 5-year coin, saying goodbye to everybody because he went back to college, he got his CPA, and he got a big, huge job in Chicago. And he was getting celebrated for his sobriety. And I'm sitting there going, "What, this guy? This guy was nuts." You know, I had leveled him in my mind. And here he is turning his life around. Proof, more proof in the pudding that this could really work. And I started to believe. I started to find some faith, at least in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was coming to believe right out of the gates. And I needed it. That was the my humble beginning of moving from this guilt-ridden, shame-ridden, remorse for all the stuff I would learn later. You know what I mean? The emerging remorseful with a firm resolution to change, right? And all the stuff that the book teaches us to come and to believe that this really works, that I can do this, and that you men can show me the way. I don't have to figure it out. It's been figured out for me. I just need to follow the directions. And I became willing, like every good alcoholic. Why? Going to jail, repeated failures, getting crap beat out of you, getting dumped by the love of your life. All the good things that happen to guys like us, right? Made me willing. And that's where I started. And I started on a regimen of meetings. I went to rehab like I was told, like a really, really good alcoholic, true to my form. I got out of rehab, high marks on a Thursday. On Saturday, I hooked up with a very attractive girl in Alcoholics Anonymous on a Saturday night, 2 days out of rehab. She had 2 years of sobriety. I had 2 days out of rehab. I'm not as bad as you guys, right? I mean, I'm like Joe Sobriety here, and I have a 30-year-old son to prove it. And my boy Adam was created that night, my first gift from God. And that's again, it's like that's Mr. Unique, right? Hooking up with some girl in AA to try to feel better about myself. It didn't work out with her and me, though I did marry her. What it did do was convince myself and my family that I could be an adult because I did do the right thing at that time, married her. She had two kids, and we got a house, and I got real serious about staying sober. All my chips went on the table because I knew I didn't want to be a drunk ass dad. And I started to get involved with guys that were going through the steps. And that's where I learned. That's why I'm a Dr. Bob guy. And this fellow right here, that's my man right there. Because when I read his story and all these guys were telling me this is about drinking, and I read that Dr. Bob would take high powered sedatives and get through the day and then drink all night and had stuff hidden, I'm like, that's me. I didn't see the difference between waking and baking and then getting hammered all night and having a hidden. I had a cool Jeep and I had a bottle of Goldschläger hidden in my Jeep to knock me out when I couldn't fall asleep. And I started to identify and go, wow, I'm a drunk too, and I need help. And then I was led to God. I was led to prayer. I went with these guys after Abbott Men's, and they brought me to the Oxford Houses, and we went through the third step prayer. And I tell you what an experience that was. It was profound. And these guys were like, hey man, this ain't about all bad. They understood how shamed a lot of us are when we come in, how ashamed we are of ourselves. And then I didn't understand that I did exactly what alcoholics do, the stealing, the lying, the cheating, all the promises that we break and the promises that we make to ourselves that we never tell anybody and we break. And ooh, boy, can that push you over the edge, right? When you swear to yourself and pass a lie detector test, I will never do this again and just do worse. And everything that we possibly could to not live that way. And to see that that's the failure of our self-reliance. And I'm an I Know University guy. I got a PhD from I Know University. I'm no Dr. Bob, but I thought I knew everything. I know. And that was the beginning of that starting to really turn it over to God and to take a hard look at all those problems that I had with the church in my youth and see, one of the things was said when I shared that about saying that foxhole prayer in jail, they're like, you think you got yourself out? I was like, God answered that prayer. You can get out. The worst version of me, God saved. The worst version, not the best version, not the man I am today is talking to you. The raging, lying, cheating, seven felony alcoholic who spent years bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous that woke up in a jail, God saved, got me out of that jail. And how many times did I pray to God to stop puking, to stop dry heaving, to stop whatever, to just fall asleep, to shut the voices off, please make it stop, before I got serious about recovery, before I got sober. Those prayers were answered. And I started to see that when I couldn't see it before. There's no way I could have seen that on my own. And, sitting in a room with some drunks after the meeting, and we did that third step prayer. What a powerful experience that was for me. And it was like I think you call it the pink cloud, but it got me hungry to have that feeling more often. And that's where guys started to explain to me that it's what we do through these steps where you get that feeling that stays with you, that you get at those meetings when you're early on. You feel safe and you feel like, wow, I can stay sober here. I can really do this. And then it would leave me, and then I'd have to go back to the meeting because I was scared to death, right? And they say you go through these steps, we get to have that feeling with us all the time. That's the conscious contact. Very simple stuff, not complicated. And then getting into the four step, and I found out that I was doing a four step every single day of my life. It was just unhealthy. I was walking around pissed. You ever have imaginary conversations driving in a car? I'm going to say this, and they're going to say that, and I am so right, and everybody's going to cheer for me when I walk in. That's a resentment, in case you don't know. You know what I mean? You ever get that that edgy feeling? You're going to see your family and me being ashamed, right? I got a big, huge family. We all know each other. I got tons of cousins. I don't go anywhere without knowing somebody. And you get that hair stands up on the back of your neck as you're entering, and you're like getting all armored up. That's fear. Didn't know it. Needed to be pointed out to me. And this whole idea that if she likes me, I'm not that bad, right? Using women as a drug or whatever. I'd been doing a sick alcoholic inventory every day. And what going through the process that we learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is I learned how to do it in a healthy way. To break that down and see my part in it and try to move away from that sickness that just that you're up here, like what I think walking around a lit fuse all the time. And it was made worse by taking away my alcohol and my drugs for me. And so thank God for that process. And thank God, I got my suggestion, anybody that's new or doesn't have it, find at least one guy that you can trust your secrets with, that you can just talk to and say, hey man, this is what's going on, without getting a lecture, without getting the soapbox stuff, and just as men and say, all right, let's, what do we got to do to get through this? How do we get God into our life here? Because we know our own self-will ends in disaster. If our drinking doesn't teach us anything, it should teach us that. And then sometimes in sobriety, right? That's the great thing that early sobriety taught me was, you think everything would get better not drinking, and it sucks. You get like a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years into this, and you're still acting like an asshole, and you don't have the booze to play. You don't. You got a sponsor. You got a home group. You're sponsoring guys. You're doing big book studies. You're doing everything you're supposed to do, and you're still like an asshole. And it's like, oh man, and you can't blame the booze. What is it? Self-will run riot, right? Need the need of more spiritual growth. Thank God that it's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Thank God that the point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines and we're not saints. I would have never made it, ever. But by doing that, by having someone talk to a sponsor, and Kano's my sponsor. I know a lot of you guys know him. He's been sponsoring me for 31 years. Good man. He's a guy I can go to and talk about anything, and he talks to me about everything. At some point, you become best friends. We don't judge each other. We just try to help each other become better men through this process. Through what? Praying on our defects of character, finding out what about me that makes me sick and suffering, and move away from that guy that wants to point his finger at all of you. Like my man Chuck. My apologies prior to really doing this and the growth that goes on in this was, I'm sorry you made me act like a jerk. If you didn't treat me that way, I wouldn't have responded in that way. So I'm sorry you're an idiot. Please accept my apology. Now, maybe not those exact words, but that was a sick-minded apologies that I would make rather than I'm sorry that I treated you that way. You deserve better. Or paying back monies that I owed and seeing these and then learning from them and really getting seeing myself and praying to God to take it away in the future to save me from acting out what in greed and fear and anger and all of our defects of character. And to me at this point, drinking and drugging is just, it's in the defect of character column. And I pray the same way about all of them. Please God save me. And and there's no substitute for knocking on doors and asking for forgiveness and trying to make things right with the people in my life. And that allowed me a lot of freedom. The big thing, my very big, huge experience that I got, like in regards to God's will for me and a power to carry it out that first round and making amends was never drink again. My mother, right? How do you if you got away, I wasn't married, but my mom was, I had no idea what to expect when I went to my mother. Other than I know that I had hurt her deeply. And she looked me straight in the face and said, no more of that wacky tobacky and never drink again. She didn't say in 6 months when you're off probation. She didn't say when your son graduates from high school. She didn't know. Never again. Person after person in my life told me, never again. The big book told me to drink is to die. If that's not knowledge of God's will for me, I don't know what is. And what are those 12 steps? What is prayer? What is this right here, what I'm doing now? All the things I've learned from you guys and other men along the way. That's the power to carry it out. What a gift. Just that alone. If that was the only gift I got, just think about it. What do we got here? Let me look up. 25 guys. Us 25 guys not drinking. How much safer is the world? Just us here. How much safer are our wives, our partners, our children, our exes, our coworkers, all the lives that we touch, clients, you name it. Because we're not drinking today. We're sober men. And God gives us the power to carry that out. We do this together. Going back to what my man Fitz told me. What a gift. What a miracle. And I'm so grateful for that. It's profound in my life. And that's the least, the truth is, that's one of the least of the miracles that's gone on, if you can believe that. There's so much more that has gone on since then in my life. And thank God for step 10 and 11, because I'm not perfect. I'm not. I still make mistakes. I'm still, I pray every day, very simple stuff. Please, God, save me from being hurtful. I remember going back to my brother who just did, my mother died a couple of years ago, and she got to see me sober and never drank again. From the time I made amends to her, and she told me never drink again, to the time of her death at 93 in 2022, I stayed sober all those years. Thank you, God. Thank you, all of it. And my brother was in charge of her estate. And one of the when I went to make my amends to him, he was like my protector. I actually follow him on the fire department. I've been a professional firefighter 28 years, but prior to that, I went. He always lent me money, got me out of trouble. He's the one who got me, took good care of me. And my mother put that on me. And I went, how you make your list of like, how do you make it? Well, here we are in the 8th month, right? Made a list of all those weed arm. And I had this idea in my mind of all the things that I had done to hurt him. Right? One, I realized that's arrogant. I don't get to tell you how I hurt you. I learned this that day. I go to my brother and I said, hey, brother, I hurt you. But I don't know how I hurt you. What can I do to make it right? And I'm thinking, I got a load of money. It was hit when I got arrested that night. It was his prom date that arrested me. And another good friend has two female cops arrested me that night. One was his prom date. How messed up is that, right? How embarrassing is that? So I had the list of how I hurt him is, or how I thought I hurt him. Was endless. So I'm about, I don't know, at that point, 15 months, 16 months over. And he looks me dead in the face and he says, never drink again. And thank you for giving me mom back. I'm like, mom back? I pull out the list. What's the, mom ain't on this list. What are you talking about? Right? I had all my ideas of how I hurt him. And he says, for the last 12 years, every time I went to talk to my mother, and he's 12 years older than me, I had to hear about you. And she was begging me, especially, he goes, the last 5 years, to watch over you and keep you safe. Begging me. He says, I couldn't talk to my mother about me. And how always, somehow it always became about you. And he goes, thank you, because for the last year, I've been able to talk to mom about me and what's going on in my life. Talk about consume myself. The bondage itself, the hurt that we cause others, that there's no way on planet Earth that would have come to me. And you guys are great. You taught me a ton. I've been to a million meetings. I ain't learning that at a meeting. But my brother taught, when I went to make my amends. And again, he's like, don't drink. 2 years later, I would be joining him on the Buffalo Fire Department. And we worked an entire career together. And he always looked out for me to this day. And we have a great relationship. It's not perfect. We're brothers. But I don't walk around in shame. I don't walk around in guilt. I made all my amends to my brothers and sisters. And some people told me, hey, man, don't come around. Thanks. Appreciate it. Live your life. But whatever. And it's so important for me to do those first 8 steps because I heard some things that if I wasn't solid, I probably wouldn't have made it. And thank God for good sponsorship and good mentors that were with me to help me through that process. Because for me, that's where a lot of the big freedom came from and continues to come from to this day because it keeps it clear in my mind so that that crowded lunchroom doesn't come back, so that debate society doesn't return, and I don't have to be right all the time. I don't need to die on every hill. And if you've ever taken a ride, I've been married for 24 years. I have 3 children. They're all doing well. They're adult My children are adults, and two of them are in college. One's a 30-year-old man who's married. And that day to my life really depends on, it's built around being a good father, a good husband, a good friend. Try to do my best at these things. I ain't perfect. Just try to do the things that men do. And I've shared a lot with you. You guys know I'm driving my daughter back to Plattsburgh next week. It's like a 9-hour drive, and if you're like me, you've made the idiot comment in the car ride where you got 100 miles of silence, right? I don't want to be that guy. I want to be the guy that gets in a car, drives with the wife, and we don't argue. And if I'm not right, we argue. But it seems if I'm praying, if I'm talking to people, if these things that go on in a marriage we work through, I'm pretty good companion on a car ride. And so is she. Go figure. Wow, this really works. And what is that? That's inventory. That's prayer. That's honesty. That's knowing the mistakes in the past, right? All the things that I'm taught here and I learn here. That's the awakening for me. The big, huge awakening was, Gino, you can never drink and drug safely again as long as you live. Oh. The awakening since then is, Gino, don't be a jerk. Learn these things about yourself so that people can be safe around you. Right? So that when I enter a room, I'm well received. And if I got a problem with somebody, I don't make it worse. And if somebody's got a problem with me, I stay away from them. I don't sit down next to them and tell them, well, there must be something wrong with your spiritual condition. No. And I try to clear the air with as many people as I can if I sense it. And that's what God allows me to do. That's what being awakened allows me to do. That's what humility, the all of it, patience, tolerance, love. That's what talking to guys about what's going on with me. Some big things that happened this week I want to share with you guys that because we have been hanging out a lot. I had a brain tumor, pineal gland. It was detected 2 years ago. So you do these yearly checkups, and I went to the neurosurgeon this week, and it's gone. It is no longer there. There is no longer a cyst or tumor on my pineal gland. Prayer works. I wasn't taking medication for it. There was nothing that they said, watch it. That was the prescription. We're going to keep an eye on it. If it gets big, we'll cut it out. Well, this week it said it's gone. And I had asked you men for prayer. I know my buddy Mark always says we got a prayer army. Well, it works. My family was praying for me. You guys, some of you guys, whatever. And I was praying for me. And the prayers were answered. And the weight that was lifted off of me, I didn't even realize it was that heavy until he said, it's gone. Because these guys I've worked with have died from brain tumors. Bad fires, you see a lot of bad stuff fighting fire. And I've been exposed to a lot of things that kill you even after you retire. So that was a big right? And my kids are going back to school. School's paid for. Me and the wife are, she gives me the honey-do list. I'm doing my part. I don't need a parade for it. And I'm not on here bragging. I'm just saying that I'm constitutionally incapable of being a good father and a good husband and a good friend if I'm not practicing the principles that I learned here. I am constitutionally incapable of just going along and getting along if I'm not talking to you guys. I have a spiritual advisor, Father Joe. Father Joe Bain was my spiritual advisor for many years. He passed away. And then I found another Father Joe. And to see, so I don't run off, God wills it. God wills it. Have you ever done that? You ever been convinced? You sit down, you pray, you're convinced this is God's will and it's not, it's your own will. And you go make a fool of yourself. And you say something, as the words are leaving your mouth, you're like, oh, let me grab them and bring them back. That is not God. It's at the worst possible moment you find out it ain't God's will. It's your delusional mind. So thank you, men, for teaching me that when I get these harebrained ideas, I just talk to my sponsor about it. I maybe bounce it off a couple good advisors, right? We learn in a four-step. Any business that does not take regular inventory usually fails. Well, what do businesses have? A board of directors. I am not the CEO. God is. But I got some really good guys in my life that I can go to and run things by. And we're honest with each other. And you go, Gino, that's a crazy idea. Don't go buy a Porsche, you idiot. Yeah, but I got this check. Yeah, don't buy a Porsche. put it in a bank sit on it, put it in a 529 for the college fund for the kids, and your car that you're driving right now is just fine. Yeah, you're right. Simple stuff, right? Simple things. Don't make the asshole comment on a car ride to Plattsburgh, right? Don't make everybody thank you because you pay for the Wi-Fi. You know, do the things that Amanda. You don't get extra credit for doing the things you're supposed to do. And number one, once in my life, I've gotten, by the grace of God, I've gotten 31 coins. And Chuck, I'm so happy for you in my life. You know what I mean? And I've been shown the way here. And never once have they said, yeah, Gino's a great guy. He's Mr. Wonderful. Oh, he's the best actor that we got. No, they said Gino hasn't drank and done drugs in the last year. Right? The not being a jerk is dependent upon what? Our commitment to this program. But it ain't a good boy award. It's a not drinking, not drugging award. And that helped to learn that too. And to learn that this is about progress. And that I need to continue to grow. And I'm praying to God that this spiritual experience, this spiritual awakening is not over for me. That I get to continue to grow. That I get to continue to change as a man and to grow spiritually. And if it is, and I'm a finished product, sorry guys, you got to deal with me. God, this, you know, if God's done with me, deal with it. But I'm praying for myself, for all of you, especially for my wife and kids, that I'm not a finished product and that there's still a lot more change to go on with me and that we together can trudge this road and that we together can stay sober for the rest of our lives, however long that may be, through the grace of God and the 12 steps. Jimmy, thank you so much for having me come on here. And share with you men, you guys that I know, that I share time with, that I talk to outside this meeting. Thank you for being you. Thank you for all the support, men. And I hope to continue to be there for you, men. And for you guys I haven't met yet, it's just going to make life better when we do bump into each other outside our Hollywood squares here. So X gets the square. I'm going to shut up now, Jimmy, okay? And thank you, God.